Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, hello there, football fans, and welcome to Footy Prime Interviews. Yes, it'll be a weekly edition of our much-respected and much-beloved podcast where we talk to people, interesting people, we think, maybe not. We're going to find out over the coming weeks and months from the football world, from outside the football world. Today, it's myself and Craig Forrest talking all things religion and football. Our guest today is a broadcaster. He's a journalist. He's an author. He's literally a man of the cloth as of last year. And for his sins, he's a Spurs fan. Welcome, Reverend. First time I called him this, Reverend Michael Corran. Michael, welcome. Welcome. Do we call you Michael or Gov or Rev or what?
You call me Sir. And you call me Michael. And you know, I was ordained a deacon actually more than 2 years ago. Is it more than 2 years ago? Yeah. But I was made a priest in September, October. Anyway, fairly recently priested, but made a deacon because there are gradations. First of all, you're made a deacon and then you're made a priest. And after that, the next stage, if ever, will be a bishop. But I give you my word, I promise you, that will never happen with me.
Hey, it made for a great book, though, wouldn't it, one day? But no, the collar looks good on you, Michael. It really does. Thank you. It's a fascinating topic, I think, this. And out of those labels I gave you there, broadcaster, journalist, author, you know, vicar, Spurs fan, which of those do you think defines you the most at this point now in your life?
Well, now it is as a priest. You know, I took an oath and I was ordained into the priesthood, and that, I don't want to sound too grandiose here, but that's the center of my life. And I don't always feel it, but I hope I try to always behave it. Not sure I always get it right, but no, that is the very center. That doesn't mean that the other aspects are diminished in any way. You know, I was a Tottenham fan long before I was a vicar. My dad took me to White Hart Lane when I was five. So that's a very long time ago. And I'm still in media. I still write columns a lot. I'm in the Star and the Globe and lots of places. I don't do much TV or radio anymore. I don't have the time and I'm probably too old now. But, you know, I'm bivocational, which sounds much more sexy than it really is.
Well, Michael, your dad, I believe, was Jewish and your mom Catholic. Is that right?
No, she wasn't Catholic. She was nothing, really.
Oh, okay.
But they were both very secular and they didn't like religion very much. But my dad was, he was a Tottenham fan. So my dad was a Jewish cab driver from Hackney, which if anyone knows about English sort of working class subculture, you've got to be a Spurs or an Arsenal fan, mainly Tottenham, actually. And he had a respect for the Church of England because he saw it as quintessentially English and so on. But otherwise, he remember, we would drive back from White Hart Lane every other Saturday for a home game and go through Stamford Hill, which was the ultra-Orthodox area. And my dad would cringe as he drove through it, which is not to be critical of Orthodox Jewish people. But for him, he just didn't feel comfortable with them. So I was raised with no religion at all. And when I embraced Christianity in my mid-20s, I think my dad's attitude was, if it makes you happy, just don't tell me about it. You know, it was, whatever. He was a very tolerant man.
So what made you get into it, Michael? Like, what was it that turned you religious from not being so much?
That's a good question. I was interested in it even at high school for some reason, because I went to a normal, a grammar school back then. I'm coming up to 63, so we had what was called an 11 plus back then. And I grew up in an East London, Essex area, Ilford. And if you were relatively clever, you went to what was called a grammar school. Tony Robinson, Sir Tony Robinson, was at my school, actually, just a couple of years older than me. You know, Baldrick from Blackadder. Mm-hmm. And he's a very interesting guy because he was a Tottenham supporter growing up in the area. But I think he's a big Bristol City fan now because he lives there. And big football fan, actually. But after school, I went to a couple of universities. And then I lived in the centre of London. A very small apartment right in the center of London. And I remember thinking to myself, now I've always wanted this. I've wanted to live in the center of London and had a couple of books out quite early and was doing fairly well in media. And I had this feeling of emptiness, really, and a vacuum. And I was searching and I was very interested in Christianity. And I went to see a priest and I was instructed. And I became a Catholic. That was in 1984. And was a Catholic for many years until about eight and a half years ago when I left. For reasons of it's down to me. I mean, it's not to blame anyone else. It's me. I changed a lot. And on teachings on sexuality and life and issues like that, I moved to the left quite noticeably. I had a bit of a transformation in my life, I suppose, and I couldn't continue in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, what was that?
Yeah, I mean, that was
because you were very anti same sex marriage, comments about AIDS and things like that. And then, like, I got to tell you, I like the Michael now.
Yeah, the other one was a right. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't as bad as people make out. For example, I fully supported civil union and I fully supported legal protection for same-sex couples and for employment and housing and so on. And that the comment about AIDS has been taken very much out of context. What I was saying was that we didn't take any notice of AIDS when it was killing people in Africa. And we only took notice when it was killing gay men in the US. And I think there's something to that. But I put it in a clumsy way, and that's now sort of used against me, understandably, but not completely fairly. But I was very much, but I did more damage, you see, because I was reasonable in that I said, look, we should have civil union. We should have legal protection for gay couples, but not marriage. That gave a certain veneer to the argument. Some screaming fundamentalist shouting homophobia on television had no credibility, but I did. So I did a lot of damage. And for that, I said sorry so many times over the years, and I paid a price when I changed my view on that. But why did the change happen? I suppose it was gradual, but I went to work for Sun News. I was at a faith-based TV station for 13 years, where ironically I was given far more freedom to debate issues. We had leaders of the gay community on all the time, and we didn't always talk about that issue, but all sorts of people came on the show. I mean, golly, I think I had Ian Paisley, Jerry Adams, not together.
I was on that show once upon a time, Michael. Remember that? I came on
yes,
for a World Cup edition.
You were on that show, yeah.
From Jerry Adams to James Sharman. Wow.
Exactly. We had Benjamin Netanyahu, Stephen Hammond. We had major players on there, and but only, you were the only one who really knew football. And but they allowed me to have these debates on. Well, I went to Sun News. And they were wonderful employers. They really were. But they just wanted this cookie cutter sort of Fox News approach where you just had conservatives on. And it rather, I was only there for about 2.5 years, but it really opened my eyes as to what conservatism could be. And I didn't like it. And I felt increasingly as a more conservative figure in more mainstream TV, suddenly I was the most progressive person in conservative media. And I just didn't like what I was seeing. and I felt increasingly alienated. And then I started to read and think outside the box a bit. And the specific issue that really pushed me over the edge was when, well, there are two things that happened almost, I think, the same week. Uganda was going to introduce even more homophobic legislation. It's always been the epicenter of homophobia in Africa for various reasons concerning conversion and all sorts of things. But it was going to be even worse. I mean, you could even have been arrested, perhaps even executed, for being gay. And this, I thought, was just appalling, and I spoke out against it. At the same time, there was a major charity, World Vision, which does some very good work. And they announced that if you were in a same-sex relationship, you were welcome to work for World Vision. Now, quite clearly, that didn't come out of a vacuum. There were gay couples working for them. And they very charitably, in a Christian way, I would argue, just wanted to make those people feel welcome, I assume. But not within 24 hours, within an hour, the evangelical world, the conservative Christian world, came down on them like a ton of bricks and said, unless you withdraw this statement, we will have to reconsider partnering with you, which is a euphemism for we will have to stop funding you, which effectively means kids in Africa will die. And I went home, and I'll be absolutely honest with you, I just wept. And I don't cry very often. And I just thought, this isn't you. This is not you. And it pushed me to think and think. And then I remember I was called in at Sun News. And again, they had a perfect right to do it because they were paying me well to do a job. And they called me in and they said, you're confusing the viewers a bit with some of the things you're saying. They were too progressive. And I don't blame them for that. They weren't nasty about it. And the more I did this, the more people, particularly in the gay Christian world, were writing to me saying, we'd like to meet with you. And I met with them, and that was life-changing because I really saw a beauty in those relationships and a commitment and a love that is rare. And then I wrote a column. I was a columnist in The Sun. Oh, how times have changed back then. And I wrote a column apologizing to the gay community. And that opened the gates because at that point I was inundated with wonderful letters from some from pretty famous people. I can't say who they were, but some very well-known figures, beautiful letters, and the most incredible abuse. And I mean abuse. I mean, whoa, this was like a Spurs-Chelsea game in 1972. I mean, this was good stuff. I mean, I can laugh now, but it was, you know, threats. Yeah. My kids... They were trolling my children's social media. They were calling on my wife to divorce me, and I mean, just all sorts of and you know, efforts to get me fired. Well, they did. They got me fired from all sorts of places. It was a quite brutal campaign, and I'm glad it happened because I can say I went through it a bit. At the time, it wasn't pleasant, but
well,
yeah.
I will say that you are a must follow on social just for the way you handle the trolls. Because even to this day, you receive a lot of hate, to say the very least.
Yeah, there are some people who, there's a couple of guys who just, they obsess about me. I must be way better looking than I thought because they just will not stop writing stuff about me. But the thing about trolls, I mean, if they're really bad, you block them. But the main thing is never lose your temper, never write back in anger, mockery perhaps. And if you show courtesy, they get very upset because they don't, you know, they want to provoke you. And and Twitter can be a great tool for community. I've met some wonderful people on Twitter, but you mustn't get into the mud with people. You mustn't do that.
Well, it's interesting you say that because you know Stephen Fry, and I know that he's one of my favorite people in the world. Love listening to him. He's actually an atheist, which is sort of interesting, but not uncommon. And what is your relationship with him, and how do your discussions go with somebody like him who is an atheist?
Our relationship is entirely non-physical. I want to emphasize that. I first got to know Stephen when all this happened. And so 8-9 years ago, and he wrote to me the most incredible support. And I didn't think it was him, but I could, Stephen Fry? Because I've also always revered him as a man of most beautiful intelligence. And and then we got to know each other. And I can tell you, when I was made a deacon, when I was priested, he wrote me the most beautiful letters of support. And yeah, he's an atheist, but he's not one of these, oh, you and your sky fairy, you know, child abuser. Oh, give me a break. You know?
yeah, no, he's not. No.
And I love intelligent atheism. And that, I mean, that's, I knew Chris Hitchens a bit too, because I worked at the New Statesman many years ago. I work for them again now. But so intelligent atheism, that's not the issue. I mean, I've written about this. If you have a kindness towards people, if you believe in a better society, that's what should really unite you. And that means many people who are Christian, many people who are atheists. Some of the kindest, well, Stephen Fry is one of the best people I know. He's an atheist. Mm-hmm. We have four children. None of them have any religious, well, one of them has a little bit, but the others have no religious beliefs. One of them, I'd say, is relatively hostile to organized religion, but they're not hostile to me.
And, that's the main thing.
I know, it is amazing, actually.
You know, Michael, I can't guarantee you intelligent atheism. I can give you a little bit of atheism perhaps in this show, but not intelligent, that's for sure. Faith and football, I mean, they are really intertwined in so many ways. Most clubs have a chapel. We're going to the Camp Nou years ago now for a tour and seeing that chapel there. And for someone that's not religious, I walked into that chapel and just felt something. It's a very powerful place and something that's been there for a very, very long time. Is it because, you know, it's a very working class sport and working class people as a whole are more religious perhaps than middle class, upper class? You know, is that perhaps the reason why football and religion and faith are so intertwined?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, it's been a journey. I mean, for example, Craig, when you were playing in England, I would venture you didn't know anyone playing professional football who was a Christian. Maybe one or two, but I remember speaking to the Manchester United chaplain back in the early 90s, and he knew of one or two players who were Christians, but they wouldn't talk about it. They wouldn't mention it because the assumption was that other players would think they couldn't rely on them. Like maybe if they went out drinking when they weren't supposed to or something had happened that wasn't meant to happen, they couldn't rely on that player to be one of the pack, one of the team. And there's been a radical transformation in the past 20 years, and that's been the influx of foreign players. But there was a time when it was really unusual for an English player. I mean, there are some clubs in Europe that have links to organized religion, Dynamo Zagreb, for example, Real Madrid. But I would question some of that to a certain degree. And players making the sign of the cross running on, that's often cultural rather than anything else. But you now have players who... I mean, Lucas Moura, you know, Spurs player, go look at his Twitter page. You might be surprised by what you see there. Some of the Brazilians are dedicated Pentecostal Christians. They're not Catholic. They're born-again Christian. What's his name? Alisson, the Liverpool goalkeeper. He said that he's baptized other players, actually. And, I mean, Jurgen Klopp is Lutheran, a different form of Christian. But English players of Afro-Caribbean background, Rashford, Raheem Sterling. And because they're Christians and they're more outspoken, it's enabled other people to speak about their faith. I still think it's a minority, but there are Brazilian, South Korean, all sorts of players now from other countries who do speak about their faith. And, of course, it's not just Christianity. Mo Salah is a devout Muslim. There are a number of Muslim players who are secular, but there are some who take their faith very seriously. It's been an issue during Ramadan in terms of what they can eat and so on, and other religions too. So there is that connection. I've often thought, though, that in a way football has almost replaced religion because, I don't know if this sounds too flippant, but you have the crowd is the congregation, the players are revered, the chants and songs are the hymns. The game is a liturgy. And you know, there was a time in England when if you weren't at an Anglican church on a Sunday, you could lose your job on the Monday. So everyone was at church. And we're talking about right up until the 1920s, certainly Edwardian England. Mm-hmm. Well, those guys then, you know, suddenly football comes in. And I do think people need something communal, something tribal.
So, but they use it as an excuse too, don't they? I mean, look at Rangers and Celtic, for example, as extreme. You know, the secularism there. I mean, I understand what you're saying there. It can be so positive, but it's also used against them as well.
Oh, certainly. I mean, and Scotland was particularly so. Dundee and Dundee United, Hibs and Hearts, they also had that divide at one point.
Right.
To a certain degree, Liverpool and Everton, but it was never quite the same. But Rangers Celtic is still very bad. And I don't think it's about religion. I think it's about tribe. I think it's about Irish Catholic emigration after the famine and Glasgow being a divided city. And so you have these two tribes that have been set up and they're represented even in Northern Ireland. I mean, Rangers and Celtic fans leave Northern Ireland from different ports for games. They can't leave from the same places. So the two manifestations, the two sacraments of these two tribes are Rangers and Celtic. But I honestly don't think that a Rangers fan is saying, I really oppose Celtic because their views on transubstantiation are heretical. I really don't think that.
I'm pretty sure you're right there. I was talking to a Rangers fan the other day, and he was talking and saying that he watched Celtic win the European Cup, who were actually the first British team to win the European Cup. I think Man United won it the year after. And I said, were you cheering for Celtic? And he said, absolutely not. Are you nope. kidding? He goes, I was hoping they were going to get stuffed in. And really, even to this day, it's one of the greatest upsets of all time, particular game.
I would just remind people, though, the first British team to win a European tournament were Tottenham in 1963 when they beat Atletico Madrid 5-1 in Rotterdam, I believe. And I can never forget that because I saw the Super 8 film of that game. Remember Super 8 shown by my dad over and over again? Dad, I've seen it 20 times. I'll watch it again. And
that's the last trophy you guys won, isn't it?
Shut up. And also, we should have won the European Cup in 62, and the game was rigged. There is no doubt that game was rigged, and we actually beat Benfica, and we would have won them anyway. But that's another issue. And the thing about that was the Celtic players, all of them came from Glasgow and around. There weren't even any players from Edinburgh or Dundee or Stirling. No, they were all from the local area.
That's right. They're all within 30 miles of the club.
Yeah.
Remarkable. Yeah. Remarkable, yeah. But what did this Spurs team right now, what do you think? I mean, Nuno had a tough time. Conte has come in and showed some, you know, his energy on the touchline, you can't help but feed off it as a player. There's no doubt about that. But he's unbeaten in the Premier League. They got a big match coming up against Chelsea in the semifinal of the League Cup. Lukaku as well involved. You know, is he going to be involved? You know, and its connection with Conte in Italy. I mean, there's a lot of side stories to this. But the good news is, I mean, I guess, you know, Spurs won their last trophy in 2008, right? I think. Yeah, or nine, like eight or nine League Cup. Yeah. And so it's an interesting matchup because both teams are in a great position to go on and win this tournament.
Well, I mean, Spurs were just in free fall because when they signed a manager, I felt a bit sorry for him, but I don't think he should have been signed. They didn't have anyone to manage. I thought I was going to get the phone call. Would I come and manage them? But he, you know, he shouldn't have been given that job. And quite clearly, it seems to be that Conte insisted on a certain budget and it was turned down. And desperately, I think they've said, OK, we'll give you that budget. So I'm very optimistic in the next couple of weeks. And then again, in the summer, we're going to spend some big money and buy probably five players. But Tottenham, I mean, James and I were chatting earlier. They were running the lowest number of miles of any Premiership team, and now they're running the highest number of miles of any Premiership team. And the tackling, you can see the tackling is fierce now. And if you don't play like that, you're not going to start for the team. And they do have some great players. I mean, they have some really great players there. And it seems to be working. Now, I don't really care about the League Cup, to be honest with you. I mean, whatever. I've been to a number of League Cup finals over the years. And, I remember seeing them beat Norwich in one, Villa in another. But I do – I'm doing a podcast. I have to be careful. I'm not enormously fond of Chelsea. And, in fact, if you ask me the team I like the least in the entire world, it would be Chelsea. So
why is that? Why? Yeah, give us a couple.
Well, I grew up in Ilford, which is East London, Essex area, which is very much a West Ham area.
Yeah.
So when I went to school, most kids were West Ham fans. Minority were Tottenham and a few, as always, Man United. You know. But because I grew up, and my oldest friend is a West Ham fan, I can't dislike West Ham that much. The traditional rivalry with Arsenal is a very interesting one because actually Spurs and Arsenal have a very similar DNA. And if you look at the fan base, it's very similar. You know, Tottenham have this reputation of being a Jewish team. But I would say there are more Jewish supporters of Arsenal, actually. But they're both North London. They both have a big Jewish, Irish, Turkish, Greek, Italian support base. So they're actually very similar in a lot of ways. Arsenal were a more established and wealthier team, Tottenham more working class. But when I was growing up in the early to mid-70s, the National Front and fascism was never a big thing. I mean, you know, they were never going to sweep the country. They were a tiny fringe of nutters. But Chelsea was their place. That was the hotbed. Now, the vast majority of Chelsea fans are not like that. They never were. But if you were a fascist in London, that's where you went. And so Tottenham-Chelsea games were bad. They really were very bad. I mean, like Chelsea, I remember Chelsea fans making hissing noises. It was meant to be the gas at death camps when Tottenham came on the pitch. Mm-hmm. They would unravel this big column 88 banner. 88, I mean, the eighth letter of the alphabet, H, Heil Hitler. And again, a small minority. But you know, Chelsea was the center of it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't any other team. And so I've always – it's very hard to expunge that experience. And
right, right.
Chelsea – I have friends. I have dear friends who are Chelsea fans. But for me, no, I don't like them. And the year we should have won the Premiership when Leicester won it, and we should because we were the best team. That Chelsea game had a lot to do with us not winning it as well.
Yeah, the meltdown, complete meltdown
At West Ham, we just had the inner city firm, so they were fine.
Well, I mean, you know, the ICF, yeah. I mean, all of that, and I knew some of the guys involved in that sort of thing because we were next to Dagenham, but they weren't as bad. They were, you know, I'm not saying they were angels, but it wasn't as organized and political as it was with Chelsea. And I've said it several times. I just want to emphasize, not all Chelsea fans. And who was the Israeli player who played for Chelsea?
Bukovic.
Ben-Ayoun.
Man, after him.
He said that Chelsea, and he was playing for him. He said that was the worst experience he'd ever had. Some of the things that were said, you know, you could hear the things being said about him, the chants and so on. So they have a problem at Chelsea, and I'm not sure they do recognize it, and you know they have a Jewish owner for goodness sake, and they do come out with some very noble statements, but there is a problem there at Chelsea. There is a problem, and I'm not sure. Well, I mean, it goes deeper, doesn't it? I wrote a piece in the New Statesman in the UK about this, the gestures made against racism, and mainly it's anti-black racism, of course. And things have improved a great deal, but they need to change still. But society has to change. But taking the knee is a wonderful thing, but it has to go further than that.
And you talk about how, you know, the foreign players come over and they make Christianity more acceptable, perhaps in the locker room, on the pitch. In that regard, with the game changing and society changing as well, how long before we see an openly gay footballer, do you think, in the top flight of European football?
I saw Graham Souness interviewed about this. I'm on vacation right now, so I spend way too much time going to the Facebook page, the bit where you can watch videos. you know, I've been on this for 2 hours. That's probably not a good thing. But just yesterday, I was watching Souness being interviewed about that. And he said, it can't be long now. There was a time when it would have been impossible, you know, no gay player would have done it. But in England, for a player to come out, I don't think it'll be long now.
Do you remember when Justin Fashanu, he came out, but I think that was after he maybe even come to Canada.
Yeah.
And his brother, John, wasn't supportive at all with him.
No, I remember that.
Well, it was really quite tragic.
Was John a born-again Christian? I'm not sure. I don't know if I'm right in that. But there were other
crazy gang. Couldn't have been part of the crazy gang. He couldn't have been a Christian.
Well, I mean, there was a context, wasn't there? But the timing, that would have been so difficult. But in rugby, it's happened, and the reaction was wonderful. It's a different crowd, a different environment. I'm not sure what the reaction will be. I think there'll be – well, I mean, you see the rainbow flags many clubs now. Many teams have you mentioned Stephen Fry, Norwich, LGBTQ Canaries or whatever, at Norwich. He's, I think, probably chairman of that. And, and a lot of clubs – I remember my younger son who played football relatively high level, they put rainbow laces in their boots. They had this special day where they had to put rainbow laces in their boots. And I said, what was the reaction in the dressing room? He said, nothing. When I was growing up, that would have been beyond comprehension. People wouldn't have done.
Listen, even at European Championships now, Euros, you know, it's you know, frowned upon by the authorities, right? It's a political gesture.
Yeah,
we're still fighting that, right?
So I know. Yeah. I mean, and it's thing is that's the thing. It's not political. It's human. It's humanitarian. And I mean, I know people attack England and English culture. It's very quite easy and comfortable to do that. Actually, in some ways, England is ahead of the curve. And you both know as well as I do. You will hear things chanted and said in parts of Europe that you would never hear in England anymore. Which is, England is far from perfect, but there has been progress made. But on that issue, I don't know. I don't think it'll be very long. And I'm optimistic. I hope I'm correct, but I'm optimistic that people will accept it. I mean, the football establishment will accept it and commentators will. How will crowds? I don't know. Crowds look for any weak point. You know that too. I mean, Craig, you must have heard the most appalling thing said to you. They're trying to provoke you. So,
yeah. I remember Forrest Gump came out, even just that movie alone, you know, I saw the trailer of it, remember, and I'm just like, oh no, and it's spelt the same way. Run, Forrest, run. Wow.
And there were times you were just 5 or 6 feet away from the crowd. They were right behind you. There must have been...
At Upton Park, especially. I mean, that was when I was playing... For Ipswich at Upton Park, and they were right behind the net there. It's a fantastic stadium. I love playing with West Ham there, but going there was a real, just very hostile, you know.
Yeah.
You remember back in those days, it was a different event.
Oh, God.
But of course, it goes both ways, right? I mean, obviously, you're going to be, you know, vilified by a certain contingent, but also you're going to be worshipped like you are a god. And I mean, Michael, as a priest now, someone with a devout faith, I mean, do football fans have it all wrong when they deify these footballers as being greater than gods? I mean, it does go too far, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but my Uncle Harold, my dad's brother, was offered a contract by Norwich City, who were then in the third division south. And he was driving a cab and he couldn't take the pay cut. So that tells you how things have changed. And the fact that a very few working class guys earn a fortune, I'm not going to criticize that. Now, the way they're revered, a lot of them seem to be very decent guys when I see the way they react with the crowd and things. I don't know. I don't revere. I mean, I love watching certain players, and you know, and the Tottenham thing. I mean, people say, especially when they're not from England, well, why are you a Tottenham fan? But that's not the question. I couldn't be anything else. You know, you just, and this applies to anyone who's been raised. That was always, that's my tribe, my being, my person. And you see them run out and I have this feeling. And I watched the Tottenham-Chelsea game on Wednesday, and I'll probably be on my own, and I won't be wearing a dog collar when I'm watching it, because you know I will react in a certain way.
We're all sinners.
There's certain things you can't say.
I can forgive myself, which is very convenient. But I don't know if loving football and even loving certain footballers and worshiping God are mutually exclusive. And, you know, I know people, and it goes beyond football, other sports as well. One of my dearest friends, he was killed on his motorbike a few years ago. Tragically, wonderful priest. He was a huge Leafs fan, and just, you know, enormous Leafs fan. And so I think they're different things. But, I mean, you're right, it can be a replacement. As I mentioned earlier, I think organized sport can be, because people need... There's the idea that we have a God-shaped vacuum in us. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but the idea of worship and solidarity or belief in something beyond you, perhaps supernatural in the case of religion or perhaps not in the case of sport, that's pretty much a constant. And it's always been there. I mean, you think back to when people were very poor, 120,000 people at an England-Scotland game at Hampden Park, you know, and people had nothing, but they'd get the money to go and watch that. And I think about my dad growing up in Tottenham and then Hackney, and you know, really poor, tiny little apartment that he and his siblings lived in, and you know, got the money to go to White Hart Lane as a child, and then all through his youth and so on. I don't think they're mutually exclusive, and I certainly don't believe. Look, I think goodness and kindness please God. Same way I believe that a loving relationship between two people of the same gender is God honoring. It's an aspect of love. I think if you live your life thinking of others, empathizing with others, compassion, decency, goodness, kindness, whatever your religion, I think that's an aspect of God. Because I believe we're created by God and we're created to love. And so if we love, we are honoring God. And the fact that we get excited at a football match and we sing a few songs about certain players, that doesn't mean that we don't believe in God.
Mm-hmm. One thing I did find when I was playing the dressing room, whether it was foreign players or Scottish or local players for that matter, I found that they were in touch with their community much more than I would think that some North American sports athletes are. They come from working class backgrounds, the mass majority of them. I see with the work that Marcus Rashford has done in Manchester, yeah, and really all around Britain, it's just been fantastic. And those types of things and those types of players can go a long way to helping push things in the right direction as far as our culture goes.
Oh, yeah. Well, Rashford in particular, Marcus Rashford changed British politics. I don't mean forever, but he changed British policy, certainly. And he did it in such a charming and gentle way. And he wasn't really partisan. I mean, I'm sure he has a party that he doesn't vote for, I can imagine. But you know, he didn't come out in that way. It was just, look, certain things are wrong. And for those who don't know about this, it was... giving school meals to kids during the pandemic when they weren't at school. And he said, well, you know, beyond that, these kids can't always, and he just pushed it and pushed. And, you know, a beautiful, wonderful young man. But I think a lot of players are doing good work. There's also a difference, actually, in terms of British North American sport when it comes to religiosity, because the American, not so much the Canadian, but the American attitude towards Christianity is a different one. And there are too many American Christians seem to think that Christianity was founded somewhere in the Midwest. And it wasn't. It was founded in Southwest Asia, the Middle East. I mean, it comes from Jerusalem and then it moved through that. And it is, well, I believe it's a revolutionary faith, a radical change and transformation. But it's not nationalistic. It's not about patriotism. And it's not about victory. And there is a tendency in the US where there are a lot of chaplains around sometimes to pray for victory. Well, that's ludicrous. God is, well, God obviously is a Tottenham fan, but God is not saying, I want one team to win. Now, I know some of the work the chaplains do in England, and what they pray for is the safety of the players. They pray that every player will leave the pitch today safely and not badly injured. That's what they pray for. And it is very different, and it's much more subtle. And not to give anything away, but the chaplains I know, a lot of the work they do is with players who have long-term injury, who get very bored, young players who are released from a club. You're told from the age of 10 or 11, you're the greatest thing to have ever been born. And the age of 17, you're told, I'm afraid we have to let you go. And it can be devastating for them. So they work with them. And, I know a chaplain who helped a very well-known player, actually, through his wife having a late miscarriage. It's the sort of thing they do. They do wonderful work, but it's not about they're not in the dressing room anyway, but it's certainly not about saying, let's have a prayer circle here. Can you imagine asking some players to get in a prayer circle?
Yeah, I know. Can you imagine Sean Dyche getting his guys around him for a quick prayer? I just can't see it at Burnley. But when you do see a player, scoring a big goal and pointing to the heavens or thanking God post-match for this win, how does that make you feel? To me, it seems quite disingenuous in many ways.
Oh, I know what you mean. Well, I remember Frank Lampard. I think it was his dad who died, and he was just
his mum. I think it was, yeah.
So sometimes the gestures can be misread. It can be one of humility. There are some Muslim players who fall to their knees, and I think that will be an act. I'm not qualified to discuss Islam, but I think it will be an act of humility. And so, if we think about it in that way, this is not me. Now, again, it's not, God has not said, I want this team to score, but something greater than me. I don't know. I mean, yes, I do understand it can appear crass at times. It's just a score, and you've done something very clever there, or you've been lucky and you've scored and God wasn't involved. I like in an optimistic way to think they're saying it's something better and greater than me.
What was Maradona saying in 86?
He was saying he was a cheat.
That's right.
Although every time I've seen an interview with someone who knew him, he always comes across as being a really nice person, actually, who was quite helpful to others. And
that's not how we paint him.
No,
he scores a couple of goals.
Mind you, they were the better team, but that That is a long time. I don't know. I mean, players can be, Craig, far more about this than I do, but I'm trying to think what things I'm allowed to say. Well, I think I'm allowed to repeat this. The former chaplain at Manchester United, he was dealing with Roy Keane over something, and Roy Keane asked him if he could help. And the chaplain, who was, a Baptist, actually, but he said, I can. He said, but, the Catholic priest locally, I can put you in touch with him if you like. And Keane said, no, he's an Irishman. I've already fallen out with him.
Of course he has.
That's right. He's running out of options.
Hey, Michael, we're running out of time here, but I do want to mention your most recent book, The Rebel Christ, which from what I won't lie to you, I haven't read the whole thing just yet. I'm making my way through it, but it's
not
very
that
interesting.
Long,
you know,
it's not that.
I know. I've been busy over Christmas. What can I say? But I mean, listen. Whether you have a faith or don't have faith, it's a fascinating read, and I think it touches on what you've mentioned on this show so far today. How modern Christianity is being interpreted wrong, but by so many people, and at its essence, you really can't argue the goodness whether you believe or don't believe. The sales are going very well, I hear.
Well, more importantly, in Canada and the UK. In the UK, I was on with James O'Brien, who has a big show on LBC. Really interesting guy. I strongly recommend him. Very intelligent, very good guy. And I was on him for 10 minutes, and the sales went through the roof. But hasn't broken.
I can't guarantee the same with this. I can't guarantee the same.
Oh, I'm sure.
You never know. You never know. Let us know if it is the case.
What I would say, I don't want to get too religious on you, but God chose a specific time and place to become one of us, to become human. And he chose to be the son of a teenage Jewish girl living under occupation. And he grew up in a working class family. And then as an adult, he owned no property and he lived in a communal sense. He hung out with people who were despised by many, former sex workers, terrorist leaders, tax collectors, working class people. He called for forgiveness and love. He condemned wealth and materialism and legalism, and he was eventually executed and murdered, tortured for his views. And he knew that would happen. So he came to be with us knowing he would suffer. But you know, he could have come as a monarch or a warlord or an investment banker or anything else, but he chose to be this working class person living with those on the fringes. He was a revolutionary figure. I believe he was a son of God too, but he was a figure who called for the world to be transformed, for equality and redistribution of wealth and love and inclusion, not the conservative caricature that is painted by so many, particularly in North America.
Well, good luck with the book, Michael. I do recommend all our listeners buy it, give it a chance. It's fascinating reading for sure. And this has been a great conversation too, Michael. We know you're a massive football fan. You really know your stuff, and you're always welcome on this show to discuss Thank whatever you. You like, basically, be it Spurs, be it God. We don't care. Just come
well,
on.
They're interchangeable in many ways.
Awesome. And you look great in a collar. It really does look good on you.
It does, yeah. I'm going to say, well, I'm a little bit, you know, I grew up in Catholic schools, so I'm a little bit intimidated. But
So you should be. I mean, there are some photos of me in a Tottenham shirt as well, but this is better.
Michael, thanks so much. Really enjoyed this.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks, guys.
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.